Sourcing Matters podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Today, I'm welcomed by my good friend and confidant, Jen Hashley. Hey, Jen, how you doing?
I'm great, Aaron. Thank you.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you, and it's always fun to talk with you. I always learn something new.
Me too.
Well,
and you have such amazing guests. It's hard not to learn anything new.
It is exciting, yes. Hey, Jen, a little bit about your background. Jennifer Hashley has become a household name in communities of sustainable farming. Spawned out of the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, the New Entry Sustainable Farming Project program is one of the first initiatives nationwide to help immigrants and refugees develop commercial farming opportunities. Now, 20 years in, Jennifer continues to help new farmers excel in the field, and New Entry gives them the tools to do that. It's a revolutionary program that looks at sustainable and regenerative farming as jobs creation and economic growth for regions often in need of stimulus. Additionally, in partnership with her husband, Jennifer runs a diversified pasture-based livestock operation and Pete and Jen's Backyard Birds in Lincoln, Massachusetts. And we are her last obligation before Jennifer goes on vacation. So I thank you for your time, Jennifer.
You're welcome.
I don't know if you saw the news regarding the EPA and our drinking water. Science Magazine teased me this morning with an article titled "EPA Blasted for Failing to Set Drinking Water Limits for Forever Chemicals." So I clicked to learn more. The article states that after intense pressure from politicians and environmental and public health groups, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, just published a plan to tackle industrial chemicals known as PFAS that are showing up in our drinking water across the nation. It continues by pointing out that critics say the plan is vague and lacks regulatory teeth and will do little to reduce health risks. PFAS chemicals are widely used to make nonstick and waterproof products, including foams used for to fight fires. The component can persist in the environment for decades, leading some to dub them as forever chemicals. Studies have linked them to cancer and developmental defects, infertility, many other raising health concerns associated to that. Jennifer, it's the gift that keeps on giving, it sounds like. And when you scramble up those Sunday morning eggs on vacation, you can take them on vacation with you, and it sounds like you can come home to them as well.
Oh, great. Well, that's a wonderful gift.
Isn't it?
Not.
It's so nice. Democrats and activists say that the government is not moving quickly enough. I don't know if Republicans and independents are drinking water as well, if this is something on their platform or their concern, but it's something that we have to find common ground on. This is our drinking water. I don't know if folks don't believe in the science, or maybe that the impact on the surrounding, or maybe even the chance that this foam or varnish or lacquer could create a nonstick surface in our gut or maybe our arteries and be the end-all be-all, the savior for the great new weight loss trick, or maybe health plan. There you go. We'll just coat everything with this lacquer, right? These chemicals.
Everything will just flow right through you.
There's our plan. Probably not, right? So the article explains that some scientists welcome the plan's focus on collecting more data on a wider range of PFAS chemicals, and there are hundreds of them. And by 2020, the EPA will monitor PFAS chemicals more broadly using more sensitive tools to enable detection at the lowest concentration. Acting EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler said in a press conference that no matter how long it will take, they will look to limit this and put up a force to address this. But he emphasizes that every intention of enforcing an existing EPA health advisory level, which is now set at 70 parts per million, I should say, he has every intent to enforce those existing EPA 70 parts per million. I would say that for my primary question is to you, Jennifer, and for all of us, can we really trust what Andrew Wheeler has to say, and this entire administration for that fact? Have they shown us anything that we can put our cards in their hands and allow this to take place? And as a concerned citizen of the United States and as a concerned dad, I'm not too encouraged by anything within the Scott Pruitt coaching tree of the EPA. You know, and what are we going to do with these guys? Can we trust them to do the job? Are they the agency that's acting in the front line of defense for our planetary, human, and public health risks? Something to ask, something to look into. Today, we're going to dig deeper into this, and we'll talk to an expert and ask them what they think of this situation. Today, we're going to welcome the president of Whitman Strategy Group and former administrator of the EPA for President George W. Bush, Governor Christine Todd Whitman. Hello, Governor Whitman. How are you doing today?
I am doing very well. Good to speak with you.
You as well. Thank you for taking the time. My first question for you is, should we be concerned with these forever chemicals in our water?
Without a doubt. I mean, this is a long-lasting poison. There are just no two ways about it. We're finding out more and more all the time. Even before I left the agency, we were seeing signs that it was an endocrine disruptor, turning some frogs into hermaphrodites. I mean, maybe some people would be happy with that, but I don't think so. And in any event, these are long-lasting, as you point out, chemicals that will cause huge problems down the road. And so we really need to be concerned, and we need to be focused on what we can do without them. That's the point. I mean, they do make life easier in some ways. They provide us with nonstick pans, all sorts of things. But on the other hand, are we willing to sacrifice our health for that? And, oh, by the way, people are discovering alternate chemicals that can be used to ensure that you can have the same outcome without endangering health.
It is there are certain chemicals that have come to mind, like mercury being one of those heavy metals that we used throughout everything back in the time. We realized there was a mistake and moved on, and now we come out with innovation and new opportunity.
We haven't exactly moved on mercury.
I know. My mouth is full of metal. So I can only imagine. I like go to bed at night worrying that, oh my gosh, I'm filled with this Mad Hatter's disease. So Jen, when I get on these long rambles, it's not my fault.
That's right.
Yeah. A little more about your background and your bio. So Christine Todd Whitman is an American Republican politician and author who served as the 50th governor of New Jersey from 1994 to 2001 and was the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency for President George W. Bush from 2001 to 2003. She was New Jersey's first and to date only female governor, and is also the first Republican woman to be reelected governor. Whitman is currently, as we talked about, the president of Whitman Strategy Group, a consulting firm that specializes in energy and environmental issues. So, Governor Whitman, you were involved in a few head-to-head in your time during the EPA, some around climate change, some around water quality. How much power does the administrator have in the EPA versus the role of what the president's will is?
Anybody in an appointive office like that does the will of the president. I mean, you weren't elected. They were elected. The president, the vice president were elected. And your job is to give them the best possible advice, tell them when you think they're getting off the rails and this is a wrong avenue to go down or what they need to do more and better. But they're the ones who make the final decision. So as much as you can be upset at Andrew Wheeler, and I certainly am because he knows my problem with him versus Scott Pruitt, as Scott Pruitt was so ethically challenged that it was almost laughable. But a lot of what he did when he was talking about rolling back regulations was really for public consumption and wasn't going to change anything because there's a process you have to go through, and he just didn't go through it. It was for headlines, for, I guess, his eventual run for something. I don't know what. Now, Andrew Wheeler, he does believe in the role of the agency. His problem is that he really doesn't have that much freedom because you serve at the pleasure of the president. And when they tell you to go, when that administration tells you to go somewhere, that's where you go.
Are there other ways that you found during your time there that you were able to move things forward that may not have been as politically popular?
We were able to get some things done. We actually got the first major piece of environmental legislation through since 1990, back in when we first got there. And that was because you work quietly. You don't try to hide anything from the administration that you serve. That's not what you're supposed to be about. But you can take and bite off some of the smaller things and get people to pay some attention. And we were able to get some things done. We did get the brownfields legislation through. We did get watershed-based management for precisely the kind of issues that you're talking about on chemicals and other things that we're getting into water systems, and better ways to try to clean them up that weren't quite as expensive as some of the alternatives. And we made some progress there, but you eventually run into a point, or at least I did, where there was a particular regulation that the administration wanted to change, and I'd been working on it and with them for 2.5 years, because it was 2.5 years before I left, and they finally made a decision that they wanted to go in a certain direction, and I just could not support that direction. So I basically said, look, and didn't say, I understood. They had a right to decide what they wanted. They had a right to set this limit. It was about a limit where they wanted it set. And, you know, I couldn't do that. They had the right to have an administrator who could sign it in good conscience and enforce it. And I couldn't do that either. So you just step aside.
Do you, I've known your work from the brownfield legislation. I mean, that was a big deal. That was moving in the right direction from holding organizations, companies responsible for perpetual and ongoing contamination of lands and soil. And I think it was one of the first, almost as an awakening to people that, boy, in your backyard, you got some big issues, and it is contaminating water or natural resources. But you had mentioned, Governor Whitman, the maybe the straw that broke the camel's back for you, and it was a decision around limits. You said, was it relating to climate change, which was just percolating as a discussion point at that point?
No. This was about an air quality regulation, Clean Air Act regulation. It was something called routine maintenance, repair, and replacement, and it had to do with power plants and others that were putting out chemicals. And back when I was governor, I had been part of a party to a suit against the major companies that were, and utilities that were, just breaching every rule of the Clean Air Act and fiddling with this, because Congress put this into the law, but they never defined what routine was. And that was being interpreted in different ways in different parts of the country, because the agency, as every department does, has regions, and we had 10 regions. And right at the end of the Clinton administration, they decided to come down hard on this. And so they went after everybody, and many smaller utilities that were actually doing the right thing and had been told they were well within the limits of what they at that time were defining as routine. And all of a sudden they were told, no, you were doing it wrong. We're going to fine you, and you got to make all these changes. And so the Bush administration came in saying, we got to define this. And I agreed. I said, something has to be done. The point was where you set the limits, because if you set them too high, the ones that want to take advantage of the system, that want to, say, change one blade of a fan out every 6 months and say, well, this really isn't impacting our output to the extent that we now have to go through the Clean Air Act again, which is what this was all about, they wanted to set it too high. And I thought the really bad actors were going to get away with it. I was comfortable with giving some leeway to the people who've been trying to do it right. And, you know, we're not taking advantage of it, but they wanted to set it too high, so I just couldn't go there. And I couldn't find, what we couldn't find, any of us actually, we couldn't find a scientific justification for that particular limit. I mean, we just couldn't find, we couldn't make the math, as it were, the science work to say, yes, this is where it can be and should be. It just wasn't. And so I said no.
It's quite interesting, because the climate has become such a partisan aspect of politics. Did you find in your time as a Republican and dealing with individuals, did you find a ideology affecting the ability to govern properly, govern all properly for shared resources?
You know, it's hard to say. I was, when I went into EPA, I was prepared for real pushback from the Democrats. I mean, they warned me when I went for my courtesy hearings that we're going to be watching your every move, and if we think you're doing something bad, we're going to get you, kind of thing. I wasn't prepared for the Republican pushback to the degree that we had it. And unfortunately, the Republicans, not unfortunately, they were controlling, but they were controlling both houses at the time. And the Republicans on the Environment and Public Works Committee just had no interest in doing anything. And so it was always difficult when I had to go up to testify. It was not always a pleasant experience, shall we say.
I would guess. The hot seat, right?
That's right.
Well, it's a hot seat is fine, but when they really just don't want to hear, and Jim Inhofe was chairman of the committee then, a perfectly nice guy, and I think a decent senator for his state, but, you know, he's the one who took a snowball down to the well of the Senate and threw it at a page saying, tell me about climate change, global warming, which is showing an ignorance of the difference between climate and weather. And weather patterns happening in your particular area at any one time. There's a vast difference.
Yeah.
We're not talking about that. We're talking about long-term trends.
That's right. And by the way, I ate 3 square meals today, so global hunger must be over too, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, that's the kind of thinking that gets you into a lot of trouble. I mean, this is a serious issue we're facing, and if we don't stand up and say we've got to start taking it seriously, we're going to find it's going to be very costly to recover from it. And it's also, the irony to me is that it was Ronald Reagan who put climate change as a regular part of the National Security Administration agenda.
Hmm.
Now, he was not a huge climate change believer in terms of this is the fault of people, but he knew something was going on. And he knew that this was going to open up areas of the world where we were going to need to respond, and it was going to have impacts that we needed to watch. But now we don't want to talk about that at all.
Hmm. Let's take a step back and look at a little earlier in your career. So from January of 1994 to January of 2001, you served as the 50th governor of New Jersey, as we stated before, and you were the first governor in the state's history. During your tenure...
female governor.
I'm sorry, what I just said?
Oh, yeah, first governor. Female governor. Yeah.
Oh, sorry, first, sorry, governor. Pardon
Important
me.
Distinction.
Yes, it was. I apologize.
There is a distinction.
During your tenure, Whitman earned the praise from both Republicans and Democrats for her commitment to preserve a record amount of New Jersey land and permanent green space. And you also recognized the Natural Resource Defense Council as having instituted the most comprehensive beach monitoring system in the nation. So you had 7 years of managing the 9 million folks in the Garden State, and you grew up in your family farm in Oldwick, New Jersey, from what I read. What sticks out in your mind about that experience, and did you contemplate running for higher elected office after coming out of Trenton?
No, that was never a focus of mine. If you want to be president, you got to want it more than anything else in the world, and I just didn't. I loved my job. I was very lucky to have been a governor, especially of New Jersey, because the New Jersey governor is constitutionally the most powerful in the 50 states, so it gives you an enormous ability to make a difference, make a positive difference in people's lives. And so it was a real privilege. But I had no desire or thinking about, now I want to be president, now I want to take the next step. Other people were saying that about me, but that wasn't where my head was.
Hmm.
Yeah, we were just talking earlier about, you know, governorship is kind of a springboard for some big next steps, and we're seeing a lot of that, you know, starting to play out now. How would you advise other people to use that experience to build their path?
Do the job you're in. I've seen too many people decide that I'm going to be a governor so I can be a president, and that's just the wrong motivation. If you don't do the job that you're given, the job that you're in, the next one isn't going to happen. You're going to get into trouble. We've seen that again and again. Certainly in New Jersey, we've seen it a couple of times where governors lost their focus on the state, and that got them into trouble. And so it's really do the job you're in, and the next one will come if you want it to and if you want to work hard. But you've got to believe that what you're doing is important and show that you can manage. I'm all for, in our next president, someone who has had executive experience. We really need that. It's not an on-the-job training position. Let me say, it's something where you have to have had some experience at this, at managing this. And within the political framework, it's not good enough just to have been, I don't believe, a CEO of a private company, because it doesn't work the same way. I think President Trump is finding that out every day, that he can't just tell people they're fired and they're fired, or tell people this is what they're going to do and, you know, ignore the Congress. There are three branches of government. There's a Constitution, all those things you've got to pay attention to. And if you don't have the sensitivity to understand that, you find yourself getting into a lot of, you can find yourself getting into a lot of trouble.
I'd read that the presidency and that office and the demands of that office amplify or maybe exacerbate personal traits. So if you're ethically challenged to begin with, that gets amplified within the Oval Office from what I've heard. And I have not sat there, but I do want to continue this thought of a presidency. And I read in your background, Governor Whitman, that your parents were very politically active. In fact, they took you to your first political convention in 1956 for the renomination of President Dwight Eisenhower. And hey, Jennifer, we know that guy, right?
We sure do.
Yeah.
In
fact, the three of us had met related to your involvement with the Eisenhower Fellowship Program. So, Governor Whitman, if you could you tell us a bit about your involvement as the vice chair of the Eisenhower Fellowship Board of Trustees?
Well, as you well know, the Eisenhower Fellowship Program was started as a gift to Dwight David Eisenhower. But when he was asked what he would like, he said, the most important thing in the world is getting people to know one another, people to people. And so what was started was a program, again, that you know well, that brings people who have shown success between the ages of 35 and 42 to the United States. When it was first started, they came for 6 months because it was very often the first time for them to come to the United States at all, their first experience with the country. And it was what happens is they have to say what they hope to get out of it. They've already proven themselves to be leaders in their areas and their field, but what more can they do for the world? What more can they do for their community or their country by expanding their horizons? And they will give now, they give a list of people they want to meet with, businesses they think they'd like to talk to, or politicians, or healthcare. We're all over. It's everything. And they come over and they spend now 6 weeks in the country because it's harder to get away in today's high-paced world. It's harder to get them away for the long periods of time, but when we can and have the resources, we bring the family, at least the wife, with them for a period of time and give them this exposure, even though it's not for many of them anymore the first time they've been to the United States. It's a different experience. We had one on, I can't remember whose class it was in, a young woman who was a violinist. And she said, look, I've been to this country a lot of times playing concerts, but I've never thought of myself as a leader. Now, all of a sudden, I have a whole different perspective that I am and can be a leader. And so we've had some outstanding, well, all our fellows are outstanding, but we've had some really impressive leaders, and we tend to continue that way. And it's a real privilege to be part of it because it's wonderful to see. They come from all over the world, and we also send Americans overseas. I've been pushing and pushing to get us to do more of it, which we are now doing. We're sending more Americans overseas, and that's what we have to do. People have to understand about other cultures, about other histories, about other countries, and how they do and face the kinds of problems that you might be facing in your business or industry, because we're not all that different. We really are all the same in many ways.
Yeah, I feel like that definitely the people to people and just, yeah, broadening your horizon and perspective and building your global network is so critical to the work that everybody that I've met in the network does on a daily basis. And it's been an amazing experience. So thank you for your support of that. I'm wondering,
just going to say, and we now have the youth program that we're working on even more to bring young people in to start them on this path and let them know they can be leaders, they can make a difference. You don't have to be older. You know, you can start making a difference as a young person, and that's an important message to get out there, too.
Yeah, I'm continuously inspired by other folks that come from all over the world or the folks we meet from the domestic fellows, and to hear their story and the time they put into it is it's awe-inspiring. So, Jennifer, I interrupted. Sorry, you had a question.
No, I think that was great.
Okay, cool. Well, and I would just say that having that opportunity and us being in it for the last few years and seeing that global network of change agents, which I think is a terminology they've adopted, is quite incredible. And you sit in the room with these folks, and I I've joking with you before, Jennifer, I still wait for that call. They're like, it was nice that you had a global trip to go look at these things, but thanks for participating. You got the wrong errand, right?
Exactly. I know, that's wonderful. I mean, how we maintain connection with each other and the broader network afterward. I mean, it's kind of cheesy, but, you know, being Facebook friends with all these amazing leaders and seeing what they go on and continue to do in their daily lives is inspiring almost on a daily basis. And you're like, wow.
Well, the network is what's so important. I mean, you can leverage your experience and really make a lot more out of it and get a lot more out of it by connecting with the other fellows. And as you say, they don't all have to be in the same field that you're in for it to make a difference. It's just talking to a lot of people that have different ideas, and then people find crossovers, and it's great to see somebody from Africa will start linking up with someone from Ireland or Norway because there are things they can do together. They can leverage. They're each in slightly, they're in different fields perhaps, but they've seen ways that they can make a connection to broaden the impact of what they're doing, and they are change agents.
Yeah. It's and considering we have a very limited State Department, I think it actually operates a bit like a little American State Department for us. Here you go. Governor Whitman, for my last question, I wanted to ask, you have, in looking at further on your bio here, you have many boards, many organizations you're involved with. You're well-versed across the board, as we've talked about. So what, in the next 2 years, the next 5 years, what do we really need to focus our efforts on? Is it water, like we talked in the beginning? Is it climate? Is it finding commonality with our fellow patriots?
Well, I've said from an environmental point of view that the number one issue of this century is water quantity and quality, both in the United States and around the world. And that gets you into things like climate change, those things that if we don't talk about, they aren't really happening. And I think that is terribly important. But I will tell you, the thing that disturbs me the most about what I see going on and the impact that this administration's having is this attitude that, you know, it's okay to judge somebody by how they dress, where they come from. If you're a South American, you got to be a rapist or a killer if you come from Mexico. We just know that now. You're a drug dealer. And while we have always dealt with and fought with and had to balance innate prejudices that all of us have, it's never been okay to express them publicly and verbalize them, and now that's happening. And the message that's being sent to children, particularly about what's okay, how you can interact with other people, how you should judge other people, it's going to be a long-term issue with which to deal, I believe. And that troubles me greatly. I have 7 grandchildren, and fortunately they're in families where that's not going to take hold, but you know what? It might. And one of my grandsons comes from the Sub-Sahara. He comes from the Congo. And I worry about how he's going to be treated. I worry how people are going to interact with him, and that just shouldn't be. I mean, he's a wonderful young man and a great kid, and it shouldn't be that you have to worry about, will he be discriminated against because he is Black?
Mm-hmm. Do you think that this recent outpouring of interest in politics across the spectrum by people of color and women and others, I mean, you are a leader in your time of, you know, being the first female governor of New Jersey. Do you see that folks are rising up now to address those issues head on? And what advice would you give them from what you learned from your time?
Well, it's ironic to me that Trump has spurred this, and he spurred having more women run for office. And I loved it in his State of the Union where he said, congratulations to women, thinking women in general were doing more, and all the Democratic women stood up and cheered. And then he handled that well, and let's say he did that gracefully at the end. But that's the irony, that he has gotten people to understand. When I give speeches and people say, how did we get here? My reaction, and I don't mean to be glib about it, is look in the mirror, because a lot of this comes from the fact that we have not been voting in things like primaries, which is your first opportunity to determine who's going to represent you. And if you don't vote, you're leaving it to let me back up a little bit, the average voter turnout until this cycle in primaries was about 10%, 10 to 12%. It wasn't much better on this one, but a little better. When you do that, you're leaving it to the most partisan people to make those really important first choices. And what happens then is you get up and say, well, I don't like either of these choices, and so a pox on both your houses, I'm not going to vote in the next election cycle. And that's just the wrong response. And it's something that we have allowed to happen over time, which has fostered this hyper-partisanship we have today, because so the people who are being elected are so partisan, and then you've had the redistricting for Congress anyway, where you have the districts drawn so that no incumbent has to worry about really anything, the general election, they just have to worry about the primary. And so that keeps driving the wedge further and further, driving people further to the right or to the left. And we're ending up in a not very good place, but we're the only ones that can change that. It's the beauty of our democracies. We're the ones who can and have the responsibility to decide who our elected leaders are. And we need to take that seriously, and we can, and we can make a change. I mean, the Environmental Protection Agency was established by a Republican governor working with a Democrat Congress, and not because the Congress one day got up and said, oh, gee, we have nothing better to do, let's go after the environment, because it was a time of race riots in our cities, anti-Vietnam riots on our campuses, women's movement was really taking off. There was a lot going on, but the public stood up and said, no, we're tired. We're tired of being told we can't go outside went because of bad air quality in the summer. We're tired of rivers spontaneously bursting into flame. We're tired of the land starting to look like a large garbage dump. And Rachel Carson had written The Silent Spring. And those things together forced the Congress to deal, and the president, the executive branch, to deal with this issue. And I don't think they necessarily would have, at least certainly not in that time frame, if it hadn't been for the fact that the public said, you got to do this. We're not going to live like this anymore.
Well, it seems like we're at the precipice of that now. I think I hope that mm-hmm. we can awaken the masses and continue to have people stand up, exercise their right to vote, get involved in politics, and hold our elected officials accountable. I think that's what we need to do. We can't continue to be lazy Americans and take that, you know, birthright for granted at this time.
Right.
Yeah.
I agree.
We do a lot of pointing fingers and blaming others. And maybe to your point, Governor Whitman, Trump is the great unifier. He's forcing everybody to go against him. Maybe get out and hit the voting booth here. And that ripple effect is incredible. I remember growing up in every president's picture, being in every classroom in America, and the role and the impact and the presence of that is vast. And it is an opportunity. Maybe this will drive more great folks like yourself to become back and getting into politics and policy and governing. That's
right.
An exciting evolution. So, well, Governor Whitman, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to sharing this information, this insight with our audience. I learned a great deal. And Jennifer?
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.
A pleasure.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure to be with you. Thank you for giving me a bandstand, as it were.
It was, and it was good
to... bandstand.
That's right. That's right. It was an opportunity for us because we had a chance, as we mentioned a few years ago, to shake your hand and go through the ceremony of the Eisenhower Program, but actually to sit down and have a conversation was wonderful. It was a great opportunity. So thanks again.
Well, thank you, and take care, and keep on keeping on with the network and expanding it, because Eisenhower is doing some really exciting things these days. And get on some of these trips, the Irish trip. The Irish fellows are having a big one. We're going back to sub-Saharan Africa. I mean, we've got a lot of exciting things going on.
And some really key discussions on pertinent topics as well. I love the future of work and all the great conversations.
Right.
Well, thanks again. I'll just say until next time.
Great. Thank you.